History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then take the time to listen as memories which may not have seen the light of day in decades start to come to the forefront again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Out of the nearly 327 million people in the United States, it's estimated that only about 100,000 are centenarians, men and women who have reached their 100th birthdays. That's just 0.03% of the population, or 3 out of every 10,000 Americans. In other words, it's pretty unique, and we have the privilege of meeting a unique World War II veteran today who celebrated his 100th birthday this past week in Clovis, California. Some of the folks who saw footage of the surprise birthday parade in front of the home of Dr. Gilbert Stocks may have recognized him as their eye doctor. He was an optometrist in Central California for more than 40 years, a career made possible in part by his service as a Navy pilot. But to put this newly minted centenarian's life in perspective, we need to go back to the beginning in St. Charles, Arkansas.
St. Charles, Arkansas is on the bank of the White River. At the time I was born, it had about 200 people. Look forward to 100 years and the population, about 200 people. But, that was a good time for old Joe. I mean, the population included him because he would sit out, lean against the wall in his chair, spitting tobacco juice to flies. And he was doggone good because he would get, 9 out of 10 of them. So he was pretty good. And so my dad died when I was 2 years old. And then when my mother remarried, I became the poster child for stepchildren. And I was raised by a man who was very, very strict, especially with me. So most stuff that the kids got into was my fault. And so this went on, and from then as we grew older, we began to get more and more used to each other. So by the time I left home, that's pretty well settled. I was raised in the Depression, and so when I graduated from high school in 1940, I realized that that was all the education they were going to give me. If I wanted additional education, I was going to have to get it myself. So I got to go to college in Conway, Arkansas, which was Arkansas State Teachers College. I think I started a college, there were less than $100. But luckily, at that time, anybody that finished high school could go to state college. And maybe that's why I got in, I don't know. But anyway, I went up there. They're going to give me a job of milking cows in the college dairy because I was good at that. I had milked cows at home, so I knew how to do it. I knew which end to work. So that went on for a few months. Our residence was above the dairy, and we took meals from one of the employees' wife from his house. So we would go over there and have their meals. So I made the mistake. His wife says, "Well, do you like pork and beans?" Yeah. Yeah, I love pork and beans. Well, I shouldn't have said that because, my God, we had pork and beans three meals a day. Breakfast, dinner, and supper. We call it supper back there. So about that time, we were milking cows as we came to them. So the guy in charge of the dairy there says, well, I'm going to change it a little and divide the herd up, and we'll draw numbers for cows. And that's the cow that you will milk all the time. There was one cow called Mary. She was the worst cow in the whole doggone herd. I hope I don't get that cow. Oh, I hope I don't get that cow. I got that cow. So the round we went, we would go down and milk, and her udder would practically drag the ground, and her teats were chapped and sore and cracked. I'd go to squeeze on, and she would kick me. I'd kick her back, and she'd kick me, and I'd kick her back. Then she'd put her foot in the milk bucket and rattle it around, and she wouldn't let me put my foot in there. So this went on for a while, and I was getting a little tired of it. Now, this, I am kind of poor on dates. This was in 1941. So there was a unit there that in Conway that got called up, but one of the guys worked in the cafeteria. I said, by golly, that'll be a good way for me to get out of this dairy business. So I hightailed it to the cafeteria, and I talked to the woman in charge. I didn't quite get down on my knees, but anyway, I walked away with the job. So I says, Mary, bye-bye. So I moved to the campus, but they had a program that was discontinued just before I got there. It was a program that the government thought up of doing something. I don't know what it was, but anyway, they spent some money, and then I guess when the money ran out, they quit. Then when I got there from the dairy, they didn't have any room. Well, where are they going to put me? They're not going to put me on the door. So this former program had stored all of their tables and desks, beds and mattresses and so forth in the cellar. So they said, well, we'll have to put you in the cellar. Okay, so that's where I was, and I was the only one down there for a whole semester. So I was kind of isolated, but hey, you know, it was a roof over my head. They had a civilian pilots training program there that we flew Piper Cubs, and I had always wanted to fly, and when I got there in freshman year, well, I'm going to join that. I said, well, you can't join it until you're a sophomore. Well, next year I hightailed it, and I got in. So I was making the flights as well as working in the cafeteria. So they had that in two divisions. They had it in a primary and a secondary. The primary was the Piper Cub, and the secondary was a Waco.
I do have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned you came up through the Depression, and most people alive today weren't alive during the Depression and have no idea what things were really like. So I'm just wondering if you have a few memories from those years that kind of stand out as being indicative of the way things were, the way the economy was.
Yeah, I remember there was one winter that we lived on sorghum molasses and homemade bread. That's all we had to eat. We were lucky. We were living on a farm, so we had eggs and milk. But people in town, I don't understand how they got along, because we were able to raid part of our food. But yeah, I can remember that as well. My mom was baking the bread, and get that good old freshly made bread smell, and get that in a pot of molasses and go to it. So that was quite common, and it took a long time for the forest to work out of the Depression up from the time the war was over. So yeah, it was pretty rough.
And another thing you said, you mentioned that you always wanted to fly. Can you pinpoint or go back to when that developed for you? Was there something that kind of lit that spark for you?
I remember when I saw my first airplane. I was standing outside by our house. It was a little four-room house, and I was about three, maybe 4 years old. And I heard this zoom, zoom, zoom. What in the world is that? And I happened to look up, and here was this airplane flying across. Couldn't have been over 300 feet. I don't know what he was flying that low for, but he was flying low and slow and just went right straight on across. I don't know where he went. Never heard of him again or anything. He was just passing through. So I said, by golly, I want to fly one of those. And from then on, I was hooked. And all through high school, yeah, I want to fly an airplane. Because one of my play in the Navy band. So that was what we wanted to do. And finally, eventually, that's what we got to do.
And you're talking about being there at Conway at Arkansas State, and you were in the civilian pilot training program. So this is all still before Pearl Harbor?
The pilot training was, yeah, but it was awfully close because I was out on a solo flight when I came in, and my instructor says, the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. And then told her in Hawaii, well, I didn't really know where Hawaii was, out in the Pacific someplace, you see. And then I figured, well, that's going to change things, by golly. And for once, I was right.
I'm always fascinated by how people heard that news, because I've heard all kinds of stories of where they were and how that news of Pearl Harbor came to them. So you're actually in the air, you land, and they tell you what's happened.
Yeah.
How did you see that change in things after that?
Well, about that time, the Navy had a program which they called the V-7 program. Now, what that was, if you were a junior in college in good standing, you could get in, or you could take the program and test and see if you could get in flight training. So I wanted to get in it, but said, no, I can't get in it because I was a sophomore. So that went on and was going to sign up, but the government was going to let us finish our school year so I would be a qualified junior. So that's when I got in. So I got this letter from the government giving me 30 days to get in. So I said, oh, gee whiz. I either had the choice of getting in or getting drafted. I ain't gonna get drafted if I can get out of it. So there was myself and two other guys. One was Price and the other one was, I can't think of his name. So we decided that, well, we're going to go to the Navy. So we hitchhiked. Back then, you know, traffic wasn't too bad. If you wanted anything, you just about had to hitchhike, especially if you was a student. So we hitchhiked to Little Rock, which is about 75 miles from Conway, and we took the test. And, yeah, we passed the test. Well, that's pretty good. So we're going to send you to New Orleans for additional testing. Oh, okay, because I'd never been to New Orleans. In fact, I'd never been out of the state. So we went down there, and we passed, and then we signed the papers. So from then on, our butts belonged to the Uncle Sam for the year plus 6 months. So we finished the year, and then we I caught the train. We had to go to Stuttgart, which is about 25 miles from my house. But in DeWitt, yeah, we knew what a train was. I think, yeah, uh-huh. I did get my mother to drive me up there, because I had two aunts that had a restaurant there. And so I got on a train there and went down to New Orleans. And then we got picked up and went back out and checked in to the main station. Every Saturday, we would line up for shots. So I had the sorest arm I've had in my life for a long time. So I got a shot about, especially the tetanus shot. As soon as that stuff hit me, I could just feel it just right away. But, you know, there was oddballs everywhere. Everybody has oddballs even then. Because I remember there was one guy that loved to read. After he soloed, he'd go out on a solo flight and he'd take a book with him and he'd read the book while he was flying the airplane. another one was in my class. He was a little Cajun. He stood about 5 foot four, five, something like that. But he was really weird, so he had a solo flight. He just lived up the road a little ways, so he flew up to show his parents and friends up there what he could do. Well, when he come back, he had the corn stalks between the guy wires holding the two wings on the airplane. You know, it was corn stalks. Hey, Dufour, what in the world did you do? Yeah, well, I just got a little low.
That must have been in a steerman, maybe?
Yeah, that was a steerman. We had steermans the rest of the way for our primary. Also, it probably is not known, but at that particular time, the Navy had its own aircraft factory. They were making the basic trainers. They called them the NP-1s. And it was a lousy... It was a lousy one. It looked like the Dickens and had a glide angle of a brick. I mean, you cut the throttle and it didn't hang around and change altitudes.
So if you can fly that, you can fly anything? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. The first I went out on a solo flight, I saw an NP-1. Well, I haven't been checked out on this. So I called the duty officer, and he called up in the tower, and I guess the tower figured, well, what in the hell is going on? So he called down and says, you soloed, didn't you? Yeah? Okay. You can fly the airplane. So that settled that. Then after a while, we first started out, we went to ground school the daytime for 6 months, and then we divided half and half, half on the line and half in the classroom for a while, and then we'd switch. Finally, I did manage to get through primary, so then they was going to send our class to Pensacola. We left with our blues on, your nice, clean white shirts, and they put us on a train that ran from New Orleans to Pensacola, and it must have been the last one that they made in 1880, because it had wicker seats, it had a pot-bellied stove in one end of the car, you know, and that's it. No air conditioning, you had to raise the windows, and the engine was kicking out all of this soot and cinders. By the time that we got to Pensacola, we were wearing dark gray shirts. That was a mess, yeah, but we survived.
What kind of training did you have in Pensacola? Were you flying a different aircraft, a more advanced aircraft, or what kinds of things were you doing?
We finished our basic there in Pensacola. From the basic, we transferred to intermediate, and this was the first airplane that gave us a feeling of what service aircraft was like. It was you've heard of the SNJ or T-6. S&J was the Navy. Yeah, well, this one was the same as S&J, only had fixed landing gear. We called it the SNV Vibrator because the tail from the cockpit back was made out of plywood. It was quite a bit slower than the S&J, so went through that. I had that, and then I went to instrument flying. They gave us instrument flying for a short period of time just to get us touched up. Then they gave us an option, and I was surprised that the Navy would give you options. They're going to tell you what to do. And so we had the option between fighter, dive bomber, torpedo bomber, patrol bomber, observation, and then any auxiliary they might have. So the first three, the fighter, the torpedo, and the dive bomber, all flew off aircraft carriers. And so I said, well, no, I think I would rather be a patrol bomber pilot.
And that's exactly what he would become. But little did Gilbert Stocks understand at the time how much that choice could change his life. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, We'll bring more of that picture into focus with this 100-year-old retired optometrist. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 100-year-old Dr. Gilbert Stocks of Clovis, California, originally from St. Charles, Arkansas. He served in the Navy from 1942 to 1946, fulfilling a dream he'd carried since he was 3 years old, the dream of flying an airplane. When we left off, he recalled being asked for a preference and opting for patrol bombers as opposed to carrier-based aircraft.
There was no indication that it was going to get it. They just gave us a rather, but there's no assurance that that's what we was going to get. So I got ready for our final squadron. Well, that's what I got, was the patrol bomber. Well, that's great. That's the first time I'd ever been in one of those. In fact, the first time I think I'd ever seen one. The first one we had, in fact, I've got a yearbook that they put out. I don't know why they did that. That had the picture of one, and it was this big high wings way up here, you know, and real small fuselage and so forth. So we had the first two or three hours I had was in that trainer. So then I got over into the other one. Why, it was a lot different. We flew the PBY, they called it the Catalina, and I'm sure everybody in the world knows the Catalina because it was the best airplane built, and it had the best engines that are ever built. They had the Pratt & Whitney rotary engines, and they were good because when you got ready to take off, if you're taxiing around real slow on the water, you can't go too fast or you don't have any brakes, so you've got to slow that engine down, and we could slow that Pratt & Whitney down where we could follow the prop around, you see. Well, the Army used the Wright engine. They called it Wright Cyclone engine, but you couldn't throttle it back like that because you do that, then the lower cylinders would load up, and then you added power, it would blow them off. Well, the Pratt & Whitney, you could be turning, you know, and then they had to take off. You shot it while it would take off, and it was the best engine ever built. We went to Jacksonville after I got through Pensacola. Our class, I think, had 12 people in it, and they were all ensigns except there was two JGs, myself and one other guy. All the rest of them, they really weren't quite up to, you know, like giving guys hot feet and stuff like that, you know. And so I was standing up one day and talking to the instructor, and I smelled shoe polish burning. So I says to myself, oh, some poor SOB is getting a hot foot. And about that time, my shoe got hotter. So they kind of put a stop to that. But then we decided it's going to go to take a navigation trip to Guantanamo Bay. So they divided the class up, I think, in about two, maybe three planes. And so we would each take turns flying. Big deal. I mean, why flying in the air? Or you're just sitting there holding the yoke, so it doesn't really matter. So we went down, and all we could do, talking about humidity, that was the most humid place I've ever been. All the officers' gold braids had turned green and everything, you know. So there was nothing to do except go to the PX. So that was just before Christmas. So, cigars are pretty cheap here. So I take my dad some. So I took him, I think, bought 12 boxes. So coming back, and I had a gal, and I take a bottle of perfume, you know, try to make points. So we was coming back, and so I opened a box of cigar, and everybody was smoking a cigar, and it went up in altitude, so you guess what it did to perfume? The change in the atmospheric pressure blew the stopper off, and you could smell perfume all over that airplane. Smoke was coming out the window. If anybody saw us, they wouldn't believe it, I tell you. So it was quite a deal. So from there, I wound up in Hutchinson, Kansas. That was a pretty good station. I mean, it was only there 3 months. But they gave us brand new B-24s to practice on. And in the meantime, the Navy had, and the government was building this, the privateer, see. So we heard what they did. They lengthened the flight deck about 6 feet, and they took the superchargers off of the engines because we never flew higher than 2,000 feet, so we didn't need superchargers. And they had 12 50 caliber machine guns on it, so we was pretty well loaded. So we heard that one was coming in there at Hutchinson. Oh, wow, we'll get a chance to see what we're going to fly. So privateer came in, pulled up and stopped. Three or four guys jumped out with guns on, guarding the airplane. We wanted to get in. They wouldn't let us in. We figured, well, what in the world's going on? This is what we're going to fly. Here's a chance to check one out. You thought it was gold, where they wouldn't let us close to it. Oh, that's the government for you. So anyway, after I finished that, then I got orders to go to San Diego. And then they put me out on Kearney Mesa. There was an airport out there. So we flew that, more training for the fleet. The last flight we're supposed to make was... we're going to fly from there to Hawaii. And this again shows you how stupid it was. So for a training flight, what we had to do, we flew halfway to Hawaii, then we turned around and flew halfway back. Well, we can fly that. How come we just couldn't just go all the way one time? I don't know. But we came back, we got back in the morning, and San Diego was locked in, fogged in completely. So I had to go in and work my way down through the fog on the radio beam. So I broke out, we were at about 100 feet, and there was the station right there where it should be. So I was heading in, and I saw a Ryan Fireball over on the side. I said, well, gee, this is... Now look, what's wrong with this propeller? Not moving. They had put a jet engine in the tail end of the fly bar to test it out. See, and I saw this thing going along, you know. You know, what's moving it? So finally it was that. So then from there, as I say, I got to Hawaii, and then from there I caught the match plane to Okinawa. And then about all I did while I was in Okinawa was just go out on flights. I called them white cap flights. So we just go along, and we didn't expect to see any submarines. And I was right, we didn't. Then we was getting ready to come back. We got orders to come back to Hawaii. So truck come up one day from, says, hey, we got a refrigerator for Squadron 123. Are you 123? Then we thought, hey, we're going to refrigerate. Yeah, we're 123. So it's okay. So they loaded off. Then we just get ready to go. So we kept, hurry up and get that strapped into Bombay before 123 finds out we got their refrigerator. So they did that and we took off and we got away. We stole their refrigerator and we took that back to Hawaii with us. So it was... quite a deal. And in Hawaii, it was about the same thing, and it's just, you know, flights back and forth. So then I was getting ready to fly back, and there was a crew that had been in the dunk, so they was going to go back with me. So they had no luggage. All they had was just themselves, you see. So I was getting ready to fly back, and Tower was ready to late getting my orders. So pretty soon I see this Jeep coming, timing up and screeching, and this commander jumps out of the car. Where's the guy flying this airplane? And says, me. How come you're not in the air? Says, well, I don't have my orders. Oh, that's a lie. You should have already been in the air half an hour ago. I didn't get my order. Well, get my Jeep, and he takes me over to the tower. And he comes in, and they tell him, well, no, he just proved to him that I was not lying to him. Okay, get back in the Jeep. So he goes back, and he says, okay. So he calls the commander of the base, Admiral. He says, Admiral, I says, I got this lieutenant here. He's, you know, bad-mouthing anything, you know. Well, a lieutenant does not bad-mouth a commander. No way. So I'd like to hold him over to tomorrow night. And we found, well, the Admiral improved. He says, okay, now tomorrow night, where are these guys, where are the luggage? Well, they don't have any. Everybody's got luggage. So tomorrow, I told him, I says, hey, have some luggage. You ain't got nothing but a toothbrush. So we was held back a day. So guy, oh, he was a character. We flew back and then landed, and so I went into this room someplace in San Francisco. So I went in, a lieutenant, signed some papers, and I come out an unemployed civilian, and that's about it. So I went back to school, got my degree in optometry, and I practiced optometry until 1995 when I retired. And then I had something to do. My daughter signed me up for some oil paintings. So did that for over 25 years. So I have a whole house full of 5,000 and 10,000 exhibits of good painting, you know.
One of those paintings was even featured in a calendar for the Central California Blood Center. You can see some examples of Dr. Stock's masterpieces at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we're not done yet. We heard how a refrigerator ended up in a Navy bomber, but how about a goat? And we heard where and how he saw the Navy's first jet aircraft, the Ryan FR Fireball. But where and how did he meet his wife, the mother of his five children? All five of whom, by the way, celebrated his 100th birthday with him this past week in Clovis, California. We'll hear the rest of Dr. Stock's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Dr. Gilbert Stocks of Clovis, California. I know he doesn't sound 100 years old, or look it for that matter, but as of this week, he does indeed have an entire century in his rearview mirror. This retired optometrist has described the twists and turns he experienced as a Navy bomber pilot in World War II. He even snuck in a reference a few of you may have caught, referring to the Combat Air Patrols, or CAPs, he flew around Hawaii and Okinawa as White Cap flights, downplaying the danger a bit. We still haven't heard about his closest call, and I have a few other questions for him, too.
One, I mean, we kind of skipped over a pretty important detail, because you told me some of the places you went and some of the planes you flew, but Jacksonville and your detour there was a pretty important step in your life, I think.
Yes, it was, because that's where eventually I met my wife. That was eventually my wife. The gal that was link trainer. And that was another thing. I hated those things because they worked on the vacuum. And you get in there and you in the dark, you can't see anything but the instruments. Okay, you want to make a standard two needle turn to the left. Okay, you turn a little to the left, nothing happens. Now, you turn a little more, nothing happens. Well, pretty soon that vacuum kicks in and boom, you've got a four needle turn instead of a two. And I used to hate that thing for that reason. And it is just...
And a lot of people listening don't even know what a link trainer is. Well, this is, you know, long before we had these computerized flight simulators they train on today.
Yeah, they've got them now. They're better than the airplane themselves. Yeah.
But not back then. So tell me the story. And you're not the first pilot, by the way, who I've met who married his link trainer instructor. It's interesting how these parallels form. But tell me about that. How did you meet her? What was your first impression? And what gave you the chutzpah to think you might be able to marry this link trainer instructor?
Well, then back there at my age, women was my second thing that I did in the Navy besides flying. It was flying and then women. So I can't tell you. It's just one of those things. I just don't know.
It just seemed like a potentially life-changing moment or a twist of fate that you ended up there while she was there.
Yeah.
Because you could have been sent overseas earlier?
Well, you know, it's kind of like people say it was preordained. Mm-hmm. Well, you can argue that everything is preordained because you can't prove it. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to say, yeah, preordained.
And the other thing, you'd gone in pretty early, 1942, right? The war is still pretty young. And a lot of guys I've talked to, we're kind of itching to get overseas and fly some combat missions. How did you feel about that? Was that something that motivated you? Were you comfortable staying stateside? Or do you remember having any kind of preference or emotion about that?
I was hoping that when I got my orders, I wonder where I'm going now. You know, I was looking, hoping that I was going someplace. And then when I saw a report back to Pensacola, well... that was the one turning point in my life, because I could have gone on, if I'd have gone on in, I had a better chance of getting killed over there than I did at Pensacola, because one chance that I remember that I never told anybody about it, because I knew if I had told somebody, there would have been a definite change in things. Because I was following, back there we had instruction, you know, to go out with an instructor. And then when they were soloing, we would put them in flying in formation. Three planes and with a chase plane. And I was flying a chase plane. And the flight was over, so we was going back to the base, observe what they did right and what they did wrong. And all of a sudden, I found that my right rudder was all the way in, but I was still flying straight. Now, if the rudder was working right, that should have given a skew to it, see, but, you know, straight as it could be. So I would wander off a little, but I had the tab wheel over here that I could bring it back. And I'd hit this one, it wouldn't go. I'd kick that one, it'd go. And I was going down with my rudders like this. That's not right. I said, well, what in the world am I going to do? Because just a mile down the road, I'm going to circle and I've got to land. I got to do something. So I knew that if I went up and told the tower that I was having this problem, somebody would come up in a plane and look at it and said, but I could control it with my stick and my, over here, my wheel. I could fly it okay. So I said, well, if I tell it, they're going to look up at it. Then they're going to call the tower. The tower's going to call the commander. And the commander's going to call the main station. And the main station is going to tell, well, ditch it in the bay. Well, I did not want to go into the bay, because with those extended wheels, there's a good chance to fly it upside down. And if I don't say anything, I can control it with my tab wheels and the stick okay. And if I wreck it, well, I'm in trouble. I knew I was going to be in trouble either way. One way or the other, I had, you know, I was already just making it worse. I said, well, I'm going to stick my neck out. I'm going to fly it in. So I come on around, I lined it up, you know, and come on down, get right in there. And just as it hit the ground, boom, back to normal. And I come on in, nothing had happened. Now, had I told them and they made me ditch that in the bay, why, that would have been too, and they always try to find out what's wrong, and nothing's wrong. So, yeah, you just did it for fun. Well, no, I never do anything fun if I'm going to do that. And I think what it was, that somewhere the cable had slipped off of the wheel, and the jar made it pop back on. And this is you the first one I've ever told this to. So I dodged a bullet that day.
And this was in the SNV, is that what you're flying?
I was flying the intermediate. It was an SNV, but I don't know who made it, and I don't know what the name it was using.
But it had fixed landing gear.
Yeah, it had fixed landing gear.
And that was part of your concern about having to ditch in the water, was that would leave you upside down, and that could that have cost you your life?
Well, it could have. I mean, you know, life is a mystery.
But you've never told anybody this all these years.
You're the first one I ever told it to.
Well, thank you for sharing, and I want to make sure I understand it. So as you're calculating this all in your mind, you really don't have any good options, and you don't know if that rudder's ever going to work right again, but you figure between the throttle control and the trim tab, you can bring it in?
That's right, yeah. But I know, even though I could control it, if I told them there was no way they was going to let me try that.
They would have said, out of precaution, go ahead and ditch it.
Yeah, go ahead and put it in the water.
And that I'm glad you brought that up, because I've heard a lot of stories about training flights that did end up in the water. So, and a lot of people don't think about that. We think about the casualties overseas, we don't hear a lot about the casualties stateside. Were there guys that you knew or things that you witnessed or heard about where people lost their lives or were injured in some of those training flights at the places you were?
I know that on the same station there at Ellison Field, the moving airplane has the right-of-way. Everything is all painted out, crosswalks and so forth. Okay, if airplane is coming and you're going to the crosswalk, you're going to wait until the airplane passes. Well, this day, this cadet, I don't know what he was thinking about. He had his parachute and everything, and there's a plane coming, and he just walked right in front of it. Cost him his arm. He was just lucky it didn't kill him.
And you said something a minute ago, too. You know, had you gone overseas instead of going back to Pensacola, that you might have been in more dangerous duty, more in harm's way. Who knows what might have happened to you. Out of all the aircraft that you got to fly, was there one that you appreciated the most, that you enjoyed flying the most?
The one for actual joy was the Stearman. It's a little bitty biplane, you know, for training and everything. Yeah, you can have more fun with that than you can flying the four engine. You can't do much barrel rolls on that.
There's a group called Dream Flights. They go around taking guys like you up in a Stearman again if you want to go. They even let you have the controls. They've got a two-seat Stearman. The privateer, we didn't touch on it too much, what it was like to fly. And you talked about those white cap missions.
It was just like flying a B-24, because all it was, they just took the B-24 and made those adjustments. They took their double tail off and put that monstrosity on back there.
You weren't a fan of the single tail?
Well, all I did was fly them. I didn't have anything to do about designing them, so I don't know. But I had crew of 12. Oh, there's another one that I must tell you. This happened out of Jacksonville, Florida. The Navy said the crews could not have mascots. No way, no mascots. Well, at that time, we were flying B-24s. When you're landed, the belly of the B-24 is only about a foot and a half above the ground. So to enter it, you have to open the bomb bay doors, step on the little track they have between the two bomb bays, and then up into the cockpit. That's the only way you can get out, other than crawl out the window. So this one crew, there's always one that's going to bust the they had a small goat. Little bitty goats, you know, and he's got where he knew him, see. So when they landed, every time they opened the bomb bay, it made a noise, and the goat learned that noise, so he was always the first one off. So they would, you're laughing, you know what's happened. So when they went on a trial run out to drop depth charges, but while they were out there, when they got ready to make their run, they opened the bomb bay door. The little goat heard the noise. Hey, we are home. Dived right in the ocean.
I guess that's why you don't have mascots. Well, I just had, you know, one of those goofy ideas. If you ever go to Colorado Springs, they've got the National Museum of World War II Aviation, and all their planes fly, so they have a PBY that still flies. So if they put you in the cockpit of that Catalina, you think you could take it off?
Sure. No, I can fly that sucker.
I thought you might say that. And, you know, you mentioned optometry school, and you practiced as an eye doctor till 1995, well into your 70s. Am I connecting the dots that you were able to do that because of the GI Bill?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've come to the conclusion we had it good, but everybody after us, they're just getting kicked and screwed and everything else.
When you think back on what you did in the war, your contributions, your service to our country, is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
Yeah, that I didn't kill myself. That No, I can't think of anything that's going to affect the price of eggs in China. No, I really don't know.
I think just about everything's affecting the price of eggs in China right now, the way this inflation's going. Most of the people listening to this weren't alive for World War II, and it's hard for them to wrap their brain around what it was like. Is there something you think we need to understand about you and all the other Americans alive then and what they did and why it still matters now?
Yeah, well, it'll have to get political if we will just use the brains the good Lord gave us and quit messing around and saying that I am better than you are and work together. That's what the country needs, because we're coming into another situation just like the Great Depression, and I'm afraid it's going to be a lot worse.
And is that what you saw the country do in the 1940s, come together?
A lot more so than they are now. And right now, I feel that nobody is moving in the same direction with anybody else. You know, it's ridiculous.
You're 100 years old, and people can hear how sharp you are. Your faculties are strong. You're in good shape. You stand straighter than I do. What's your secret? How have you maintained such good health for 100 years?
I don't know how many people have asked me that question. And about the only thing I got left is just, you know, good, clean living. Oh, God, that's funny. If you told me that I was going to hit 100, you're nuts.
I am, you know, curious, because 100 years is a long time. And that's a lot of life that you've lived and a lot of lives that you've touched. I'm sure there are a lot of people thankful for the way you helped them with their eyesight over all these years. Is there something when you kind of look back over 100 years that you have the most gratitude for, that you're the most thankful for, the most satisfied with?
Well, I'd have to say that the thing that I'm the most proud of is my family. I have five wonderful kids, and they're all grown. And they've got kids of their own who've got kids of their own. But they'll always be my kids. I'm thankful for that.
Have you ever wondered how different your life would have been if you didn't join the Navy?
I do it all the time. I wonder, well, now, I'm kind of like Yogi Berra. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. I don't know how it worked out, but I think it worked out the way that it was supposed to have worked out.
And anything else about your wife? I mean, what are the odds you're going to meet your wife as your Link trainer instructor?
You know, to tell her the truth, I don't know what she saw in me enough to marry me in the first place. She saw something. I don't know. If she'd had her eyes checked before, I might have not got her. I don't know.
She must not have had a very good optometrist.
No, she didn't.
But no, she married one.
Yeah, she is. I can't say enough about her, because just like a team of horses, you know, work together. Well, that's the way we were.
Well, I know there's one thing I forgot to say. I forgot to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us your story.
I'm glad to do it. Yeah.
Dr. Gilbert Stocks, 100 years young. Don't forget to check out that video from the surprise 100th birthday parade for him in Clovis, California. You'll find it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or on hometownheroesradio.com. His children told me this week that he's been talking about reaching the century mark since he was 50. Mission accomplished. And he's not done yet, as I'm sure you could hear today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.